The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. There's never been a better time in history to be an enemy of the United States of America. That's from a Daily Beast article just yesterday. Springtime for America's Enemies, says the title. While America's traditional allies in Europe and the Middle East express confusion and frustration, President Obama's White House delivers compliments and concessions to some of the most brutal dictatorships in the world. In the span of a single week, notice this. Here's 1 week's worth of work. In the span of a single week, the U.S. has restored diplomatic relations with Cuba, pressured Ukraine to accept Vladimir Putin's butchering of its eastern region, and brokered a deal to liberate Iran from sanctions. That's just 1 week, 7 days. The article says these actions would represent a tremendous series of diplomatic triumphs if they improved human rights in these repressed nations, saved lives in conflict regions, or improved global security. That is, in fact, what the White House says these deals will do, despite copious evidence to the contrary. There's just evidence all around. These negotiations represent willful ignorance of the fundamental nature of the regimes in question, especially those of Iran and Russia. Ignorance of the fundamental nature of these regimes. Last week we had a program on the plague of the human heart. That's what these developments really do highlight. Just how much ignorance there is about human nature. The article says, regardless of the wishes of the Iranian and Russian people, their leaders have no interest in peace, although they are very interested in never-ending peace negotiations that provide them with cover as they continue to spread violence and hatred. There's no interest in peace, but they sure love peace negotiations. They sure love sending their diplomats to sit down with Western leaders to talk about peace, to talk about concessions, to talk about how they've been wronged, to talk about all of the mistakes the Western leaders have made, the Western nations have made, particularly America and Britain and the little nation of Israel in the Middle East. These kinds of negotiations, as it says there, it just provides them with the cover that they need to continue on with all of their belligerent activities. Look at Putin in the advance on Crimea and now eastern Ukraine. And it's the United States pressuring Ukraine to accept Putin's demands. It's the United States pressuring Israel to accept these demands of Iran. It's an upside-down world for sure. Yesterday, the National Review had an article about the press release by Senator Tom Cotton and Mike Pompeo of Kansas about the discovery of the IAEA's agreements with Iran, separate and apart from what the United States has arranged these past couple of weeks. There are two secret side deals to the nuclear agreement with Iran that will not be shared with other nations, with Congress, or with the U.S. public. So as bad as the deal itself was, here these two senators, or one senator and one congressman, they're crying out about these separate side deals that nobody knows about, that nobody can read the details of. The National Review says one of these side deals concerns inspection of the Parkin military base, where Iran reportedly has conducted explosive testing related to nuclear warhead development. The Iranian government has refused to allow IAEA to visit this site. Over the past several years, Iran has taken steps to clean up evidence of weapons-related activity at that facility. Let me just give you a little bit. I think this is actually quoted in the National Review piece, but this is from that press release from Senator Cotton and Congressman Pompeo. It says, according to the IAEA, the Iran agreement negotiators, including the Obama administration, agreed that the IAEA and Iran would forge separate arrangements to govern the inspection of the Parkin military complex, one of the most secretive military facilities in Iran, and how Iran would satisfy the IAEA's outstanding questions regarding past weaponization work. Both arrangements will not be vetted by any organization other than Iran and the IAEA, and will not be released even to the nations that negotiated the Iran nuclear agreement. That means that the secret arrangements have not been released for public scrutiny and have not been submitted to Congress as part of its legislative mandated review of the Iran deal. Congress is supposed to be able to review the deal. And here there's two secret parts of this deal. It's just between Iran and the IAEA. Nobody else can look into the details of the agreement or whether or not Iran even complies. As I say, the deal itself was bad enough, and now you have these backroom arrangements that won't be made public. I thought it was interesting, just last night there was a protest. Thousands of protesters turned out to voice their disapproval of all the recent nuclear, the deal made with Iran and these secret deals together with it. And what caught my attention is that it happened in Times Square, of all places. It's not exactly a bastion of conservatism. Times Square, New York. They're turning out, they're calling upon Senator Schumer, a Democrat, to vote against this deal. This is from CBS New York. It says, thousands of demonstrators gathered in Times Square Wednesday evening in protest over the recent landmark nuclear deal with Iran. CBS estimated 10,000, at least several thousand, others have said. Protest organizers proclaim, quote, Washington is prepared to give Iran virtually all that it needs to get the bomb. To release $150 billion to Iran will result in the expansion of worldwide terror. It goes on and quotes a former New York governor, George Pataki, who urged the protesters and those in Washington to reject the deal to protect America. And then, as I say, they called on Senator Schumer to vote against it. Now, if only Congress would have stood up to the administration back in April, as we've discussed in recent programs. You look at the sentiment in the American electorate now, and they'd have a majority of Americans on their side. This Wall Street Journal piece, this is from a couple of days ago, President Obama's UN first gambit. We've talked about this run around Congress, as many have written, how that the deal was submitted to the UN even before it was finalized and approved by the UN unanimously. Right at about the time Congress was actually getting the deal to review it. The journal says President Obama thinks he has the U.S. Congress right where he wants it as the members consider his nuclear deal with Iran. Not only do opponents need a two-thirds majority in both houses to stop it, the president has maneuvered to box them in by having the United Nations approve it first. Further on, it says, Mr. Obama deliberately structured his Iran negotiations to make Congress a secondary party to the UN. I mean, this is not even legal. Congress is secondary to the UN. It says the Security Council vote means that the process of lifting international economic sanctions is now underway, and the pact will roll forward. So it was submitted to the UN as if it was already official U.S. law. And it wasn't. It isn't. Now, here again, Congress has itself to blame for the shameful capitulation in April. But even that legislation, even that capitulation, it still is a law. It became law in April. It was something the administration wanted to push on through to get the upper hand. Then the deal is finally made. You'll recall President Obama's press conference saying that he welcomed scrutiny of this deal. He welcomed debate. He even said he'd veto any action by Congress. And then before Congress even got the deal, he submitted it to the UN as if it was already approved law. He went right around the law that he himself was so desperate to get through in April. It reveals a lot about the spirit of lawlessness in Washington, D.C. It's amazing, isn't it, just how fast the radical agenda is being implemented. It's as if nothing can slow it down, even. Let me just give you another example to make that same point. On Tuesday, you may have seen there was a hearing. The Senate Judiciary Committee had a hearing about all these victims of violence and crime due to illegal immigrants just pouring into the nation. And many of these immigrants that should have been deported being released, set free, seeking refuge in these so-called sanctuary cities, and then going on and carrying out horrific crimes, murder in some cases. Well, at this hearing, they brought some of the family members together, family members of these victims, to give their testimony. And perhaps the best-known case, at least here recently, was the death of Kate Steinle in San Francisco a few weeks ago. And this first clip I'll play for you is a testimony coming from her father, Jim Steinle, about his daughter.
All children are special in their own way, and Kate was special in the way she connected with people. We called it the Kate effect. Kate was beautiful, kind, happy, caring, loving, deep in faith. Kate had a special soul, a kind and giving heart, the most contagious laugh, and a smile that would light up a room. Kate loved to travel, spend time with her friends, and most of all, spend time with her family. In fact, the day she was killed, we were walking arm in arm on Pier 14 in San Francisco, enjoying a wonderful day together. Suddenly, a shot rang out. Kate fell and looked at me and said, "Help me, Dad." Those are the last words I will ever hear from my daughter. Everywhere Kate went throughout the world, she shined the light of a good citizen of the United States of America. Unfortunately, due to disjointed laws and basic incompetence on many levels, the U.S. has suffered a self-inflicted wound in the murder of our daughter by the hand of a person that should have never been on the streets of this country. I say this because the alleged murderer is an undocumented immigrant who has been convicted of 7 felonies in the U.S. and already deported 5 times. Yet in March of this year, he was released from jail and allowed to stay here freely because of those legal loopholes. It's unbelievable to see so many innocent Americans that have been killed by undocumented immigrant felons in the recent years. In fact, we recently come across a statistic that says between 2010 and 2014, 121 criminal aliens who had an active deportation case at the time of release were subsequently charged with homicide-related offenses. Think about that. 121 times over the past 4 years, an illegal immigrant with prior criminal convictions that later went on to be charged with murder when they should have been deported. That is one every 12 days.
One every 12 days. We've drawn attention to that statistic recently at thetrumpet.com. 121 murders in the past 4 years. He breaks it down further. One in every 12 days. Every 12 days. An American murdered by an illegal immigrant. Not just any illegal immigrant. A hardened criminal that in some cases is detained and then let go. Deported and then comes back. That, as I said, was Jim Steinle reporting about the, or testifying about the death of his daughter from a few weeks back. This second clip is from Laura Wilkerson. It's a case that you're probably not quite as familiar with. It happened several years ago. Her son, who was beaten to death by an immigrant, and I'll just let her explain.
My son's name was Joshua Wilkerson. On November 16th, 2010, he was beaten, strangled, tortured until he died. He was tied up, thrown in a field, and set on fire. His killer, Hermilo Morales, was brought here illegally by his illegal parents when he was 10 years old, so he fit the dream kid description. He was sentenced to life in prison, which means he will be 30 years before he's up for parole. He'll be a 49-year-old man who I don't expect to be deported, and I just hope he doesn't come to live in your city. Instead of getting Joshua home that day from school, we got an autopsy report that reads in part, "This body is received in a gray body bag. There's a tag on his toe that bears the name Joshua Wilkerson. He is a white male weighing 100 pounds. He is tied up with braided rope, 13 loops around his neck with a slip knot. It goes behind his back through his back belt loop. It goes to his hands and his feet behind his body. He has multiple fractures in his face and nasal cavity. His throat and his voice box are crushed. He was kicked so hard in the stomach that it sent his spleen into his spine and sliced it in two. So it was painful. The medical examiner said it was torture. This body has significant skin loss on his buttocks, his abdomen, his penis, his hands, and his face. He has one stick of gum and a tardy slip in his pocket. This was our family's 911 terrorist attack by a foreign invader, whether you want to recognize it or whether you do not. This government continues to fail or even recognize that we have an issue. Americans are dying daily at the hands of criminals that we don't even know are here. You're officially notified today there's a problem when this happens. You can't deny it any longer. You cannot stand by and ignore our families, our American families. You're elected by Americans, not any other country. You should be for Americans. If you want to sit quietly on the sidelines, you've thrown your hat into the ring already. Your silence speaks volumes. You're either for Americans or you're not. America lost that day. You lost a good citizen that was on the brink of becoming who knows what. He had mentioned going into the Air Force like his older brother, who had to come home for 2 weeks and bury. He was out defending this country, Americans. and we had to bring him home for 2 weeks to bury his little brother when he wasn't being defended right here at home. It's absurd to me.
It's absurd to quite a number of Americans. She even mentioned one of the political candidates running for president, Donald Trump, how that for whatever you think about him, she's glad that he's bringing this up. She said it's good that she's finally being heard. She mentioned how that he's done more just in a few days to put this issue before the American public than she's been trying to do, along with some of these other family members of victims, over the past several years. But for the most part, as she brought out in that testimony, there's quite a few in Washington that don't even recognize this as a problem. And as I said earlier, as far as the administration goes, there in the White House, I mean, the agenda moves forward, irrespective of these things that are happening. This is from the Washington Free Beacon yesterday. Notice this. It says the Obama administration is moving forward with plans to expand a waiver program that will allow additional illegal aliens to remain in the country rather than apply for legal status from abroad. The Department of Homeland Security, DHS, issued a proposed rule on Tuesday that would make changes to a waiver program created by President Obama's executive action on immigration in 2013. They want to make it easier. And this proposal, it was submitted on Tuesday, the very same day of this testimony or these hearings. I mean, if ever there's a time to at least pause and hear or acknowledge victims of horrific crimes, it would have been Tuesday. But never mind that. The agenda goes forward. It says the action created a waiver that primarily allowed illegal immigrants with a U.S. citizen spouse or parent to stay in the country instead of having to leave the United States and be barred from returning for 3 to 10 years. If they prove their absence, a little further down, it says DHS proposed to expand the class of aliens who may be eligible for a provisional waiver beyond immediate relatives of U.S. citizens to aliens in all statutorily eligible immigrant visa categories. The gist of it is, again, to just make it easier on those who are already here, to not send them back, to not require that they apply for citizenship from their home country, but to just give them waivers, to push toward amnesty, to welcome in as many as we can, give them citizenship. That's the goal, that's the aim, and it's on both sides of the aisle. And hardly anyone will speak out about it. And people wonder why the Trump campaign's gaining traction. So few are willing to speak out about what's happening and how it's hurting the United States of America. And you had some riveting testimony there and on Tuesday, right there before that Senate committee. I mean, that last testimony from Ms. Wilkerson, she had people in the chamber sobbing because of what happened to her son, who supposedly may have kicked a dog and then had this immigrant come after him and do all the things that you heard there described. The boy weighed 100 pounds, had never been in a fight in his life, tied up, tortured, burned. And it's frightening, as she even brought out, to think that, well, in 30 years, that prisoner's going to be set free, most likely, and he'll just be 49 years of age. What a system. What a curse. What a mess. Yesterday, Robert Morley posted an article about that anti-racism database. We talked about this on Tuesday. But in his piece, which we had there featured at thetrumpet.com, there at the top of the website yesterday, he talked about just how the reaction to the NSA's spying. People went ballistic, as he said, when they heard about all this spying. But then Mr. Morley says here, but this new data grab puts America's spy agencies to shame. The New York Post called it the largest consolidation of personal data in U.S. history. And then Mr. Morley goes on to explain what's happening. And we read from that New York Post piece at length on Tuesday. But it's all done with the view of eliminating racism in America, or creating a society that's more fair and just in the eyes of these on the far, far left. It says the giant new race database is President Obama's keynote effort to ferret out inequalities between whites and minorities and to enforce racial and economic justice. As I say, we talked about this to some extent on Tuesday, particularly about the reforms that are now in the works for America's prisons. But I'd like to focus just for a second on the reforms that are in the works for the educational system. Mr. Morley says this in his article. The new Civil Rights Data Collection Project targets the education system. It is collecting data on every student in America based on race, as we wrote about in June and December. The government says that because black and Latino students are suspended at rates higher than white and Asian students, the education system is biased and against them. It says the Justice Department, this is Mr. Morley writing, the Justice Department refuses to consider outside factors that could cause black students to be more likely to misbehave and thus to warrant discipline. For example, it does not believe that broken families could be the major cause of student misbehavior. Schools that refuse to stop suspending black students out of proportion to their population have their funding cut. So now, for example, only white students are allowed to be suspended in Minneapolis and St. Paul schools. That's in Minnesota, of course. So as I said on Tuesday, we've got to do something to get the percentages to align perfectly with the numbers of minorities as compared to the whites, the Asians, and so on. It's already been a disaster for these schools in Minnesota. But the agenda is not going to stop there. Yesterday I saw a tweet from the White House that said the number of students suspended in 1 year could fill 45 Super Bowls. And then the tweet said, it's time to rethink discipline in our schools. I mean, that's even taking it a step farther. Presumably, I guess, it goes beyond race. Just eliminating that sort of discipline entirely. Now, in a panel discussion that the U.S. Department of Education had yesterday, they did highlight, again, the percentages and how it was disproportionate and how we've got to align these to fit with the percentages in the population. But with respect to rethinking discipline, well, let me just read to you what it says on the U.S. Department of Education website. Teachers and students deserve school environments that are safe, supportive, and conducive to teaching and learning. Creating a supportive school climate and decreasing suspensions and expulsions requires close attention to the social, emotional, and behavioral needs of all students. Decreasing suspensions, taking away what little discipline is there, in other words. Now, I'm sure the intentions of some of these educators are sincere, and there are points to be made about positive encouragement and giving people a second chance and not giving up on someone that really has had a disadvantaged background. But to remove discipline is not the answer. It's not the solution. It's just along the same lines of reaching out to the prisoners, the criminals, the bad guys. What about the ones in the classroom that really are there to learn? What about those students? What about, well, leaving aside any kind of disciplinary action, to leave the bad apples in the classroom to disrupt the instruction? As I say, what about those who are there sincerely trying to learn? Well, there comes a point when someone won't cooperate. You have to administer some form of discipline, or you have to remove them from the class if you're going to preserve the peace. Well, it'll be interesting to see where this goes. There are problems, for sure, in the educational system. There are problems in the prison system in the United States. But the solutions, quote-unquote, the solutions being put forward by the radical left, they're not going to solve these problems. It's only going to make matters worse. Why not look at the cause? If there's this many each year that are suspended or expelled from school, what is the cause? What are they doing? What about their behavior? I just want to finish this segment referring to an article that Mr. McDonald, Brad McDonald, read from yesterday. Appreciate him filling in for me on the program. He talked about some of the Pope's upcoming travels, which he's been obviously watching closely, and we'll have to keep tabs on this too in the coming months. But just to draw attention to what he read yesterday, this is from Paul Farrell's article at MarketWatch, how that the Pope's igniting a revolt that's intended to overthrow American capitalism. You've got to look at what he's saying. He's traveling the world, and he has a message. Not for one nation or another nation. He has a message for the world. Mr. Farrell says Pope Francis is encouraging civil disobedience, leading to rebellion. It's true. Yes, it's true. Listen closely, Farrell writes. Francis knows he's inciting political rebellion, an uprising of the masses against the world's super-rich capitalists. And yet, right-wing conservatives remain in denial, tuning out the Pope's message, hoping he'll just go away like the Occupy Wall Street movement did. They're just ignoring it. Well, he surely can't mean what he says. In fact, they're accommodating it. As you heard Mr. McDonald point out, he's going to be speaking even before Congress when he makes his trip to the States in September. Farrell says, never. America's narcissistic addiction to presidential politics is dumbing down our collective brain. Warning, forget Bernie versus Hillary. Forget the circus clown car distractions created by Trump versus the GOP's Fab 15. Pope Francis is the only real political leader that matters this year. Forget the rest. And he's right. These are huge distractions. Leaving aside what Trump, to take that example, has to say about the problem of illegal immigration. But look at the headlines, the banter back and forth, the arguing, the bickering among politicians. Look at the headlines that sort of activity gets. It was just a week ago today that those four Marines and one sailor were gunned down by a radical Islamist. And you haven't even heard about it in the last few days. We heard at the start, well, we don't want to jump to conclusions. There's got to be an investigation. And then it falls off the headlines. And do you think it's going to get lots of headlines later when everything's finally determined that, yes, he was influenced by radical Islam? Yes, it was a terrorist attack? You won't hear much of anything about it. We've got to move on, because there's this great political fight that's making headlines. And we've got to capitalize on that. That's the thinking. What a distraction the whole U.S. political system is. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. It's unlike any other nation in this world. A campaign season that literally lasts for 2 years and that costs, as I say, hundreds of millions of dollars, altogether billions. What a distraction. You look at all that's happening in this world. You look at the attacks. You look at the United States and Britain, too. But you look at the many problems plaguing the United States. You look at the enemies of the U.S. abroad. As I said, they're at the top. I mean, there's never been a better time. As it says in the Daily Beast, there's never been a better time to be an enemy of the United States. What an opportunity this is for Vladimir Putin. What an opportunity this is for the mullahs. Well, they're just making advances right and left. To finish the point that Farrell made in that article about the Pope's activities, he says Pope Francis is not just leading a second American Revolution. He's rallying people across the earth, middle class as well as poor, inciting billions to rise up in a global economic revolution, one that could suddenly sweep the planet. Yes, it can happen suddenly. It's going to happen so fast. My father talked about this yesterday in a program that he recorded for the Key of David. We'll be talking more about this next week. Tomorrow's program that airs, by the way, is on the Iran nuclear deal. You want to make sure that you watch that at thetrumpet.com or on television in your local area sometime this weekend. Check thetrumpet.com for the station listing. In any event, he discussed yesterday just how suddenly it's all going to come together in Europe. This church-state union, which is prophesied in your Bible. Read about it. Study it in Revelation 13, in Revelation 17. We're going to talk more about this in upcoming programs. And just dwell on the point that I made recently, briefly, about how some of these older commentaries from the 1800s just flat out come and identify who is who. They didn't get all the details right. Lang and some of the others that wrote these exhaustive commentaries. But as far as identifying major players in end time prophecies, they got quite a bit of it right. Study those chapters. Why not? Why not look into what the Bible says in Revelation 13 and Revelation 17 about this beast power ridden by a woman? What does that mean? What does that symbolize? We've got all kinds of literature that can help you in your study. Who or what is the prophetic beast? We've just produced a new book on the Holy Roman Empire. That'll be out in a couple months' time, hopefully. We'll give you everything that you need to study this in depth so that you can understand your world, so that you can know why these events are happening and where it's leading. Well, as I say, there's lots to follow in the months ahead, tracking this Pope's movements, following his speeches. It is significant, as I say, because of this church-state union that's prophesied to suddenly appear in Europe, the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show here on 101.3 KPCG in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream's available at KPCG.FM. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
All right, we've got just a few minutes here left before the top of the hour, and I'll just take a few to tell you about another book. I mentioned the one on the Holy Roman Empire coming out pretty soon. Our most recent work that we have been distributing is called The True History of God's True Church. It's a fantastic book. I've been going through it myself here in recent weeks. We produced a program on this just the other day, which we'll talk more about perhaps on tomorrow's program. I was going to get into it at length today, but just am running out of time here. In any event, this book, well over 200 pages, you need to make it part of your library and go through it yourself to understand the truth, because frankly, it's been blotted out. I mentioned Lang's commentary before the break. I mean, so many of these older commentaries, they're now out of print. They've been replaced by the newer, more modern instruction. The history in so many ways has been revised. This book resurrects that history, that truth, that true history right before our eyes. And you can see it, and you can scrutinize it, and you can prove it. You can read it and study it right along with your Bible and understand the truth that so few on this earth today understand. I mean, when Christ founded the New Testament church, he promised it would never die. For one, he didn't establish hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different denominations. He's not the author of confusion. He didn't establish one branch of Christianity over here in this area and then another branch over here, and then when some got dissatisfied, they split apart into hundreds of Protestant denominations, and on it goes. Which one's right? Which one has the truth of God? Which one teaches the truth of your Bible? You can look at Matthew 16, where Christ said there, talking to Peter, "Upon this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." God's church would never die. That's what Jesus promised. And yet, if you look at the true history of God's true church, you can see that it came awfully close a number of times, where it looked like the church, the truth, God's people, were about to be wiped out. And yet the church survived. Did you know Jesus called the church his little flock? It's not some great big universal organization. It's a little flock. Look for yourself in John 15. You can see why. It's not that big. John 15 here, and verse 20, it says, "Remember the word that I said unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord. If they have persecuted me," this is Jesus talking, "if they've persecuted me, they will also persecute you." They went after the true church in the same way that mankind went after Jesus Christ. That's why, for these past 2,000 years, it's been such a little flock. Throughout its 2,000-year history, God's church has faced intense persecution coming from every direction. But most of it, has come from a great counterfeit church. That's what's discussed in The True History of God's True Church, our newest book. You need a copy. It'll take you right through the establishment of God's true church, its amazing growth there at the early start of the true church in the book of Acts. You can see in Acts 4 that there was an initial spurt of growth that took it from 120 disciples to about 5,000 converts, 5,000 brethren. But soon after that, You can see from the same book, the book of Acts, the church faced intense persecution, just as Jesus said it would. And the people of God were scattered. Now, this helped to spread the message in many ways. You can move forward in the book of Acts. In Acts 7, the deacon Stephen there is stoned to death for holding to God's truth. And you can see right at the end of Acts 7, there's a man named Saul who's right there at Stephen, or his feet are right there at Stephen's stoning. That Saul would later have his name changed to Paul. He was a great persecutor of the church before his conversion. He was actively seeking Christians to put them to death, to put them in jail. And he thought he was doing God a service by doing so. And God struck him down on the way to Damascus. God blinded him. And God said, "Why are you going against my will?" And Paul turned his life around, and he became a faithful minister of God, and he himself was subjected to the worst kind of persecution that you could imagine. He himself was eventually beheaded for preaching the truth of God. This happened decades after some of this history discussed in Acts 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. You mean 30 years on after the true church was supposedly well established, okay, that 30, 40 years on, they were putting true Christians to death? That's true. That's why this history is so important. In Acts 8, it says there's this great persecution against the church at Jerusalem, and the brethren were scattered abroad. There was an effort going on to completely stamp out the true church. Paul, as I said, was part of it initially. A lot of that persecution came from the Jews. It came from the Jewish religion. But if you continue your study in Acts chapter 8, you're introduced to Simon Magus, who started a false Christian system, so-called Christian. We'll take some time later to go through this important history verse by verse, but let me just ask you, why is it there? Is it just an add-on? Did Luke, when writing the book of Acts, just tack it on? Oh, right, there's this incident with Simon Magus down in Samaria. We'll go ahead and put that in there because that's interesting too. God inspired this to be recorded the way that it was. He's in Acts chapter 8, Simon Magus, because of how significant he would be in the history of religion. Those early chapters of our new book, The True History of God's True Church, they talk a lot about this Simon Magus and this religion that he established and the interaction that he had early on with God's apostles, all that he witnessed, the profound influence that he had on the people of Samaria, his popularity, and also his rebellious attitude and spirit, his lawless spirit, and where that came from, and what it led to. Peter himself prophesied, "I foresee that you're going to be a big problem for the true church." And he was dead on with that prophecy. This book, our new book, The True History of God's True Church, in large part, it's about the war between two churches. The war between two churches. This is something that you're probably completely unaware of. You've never heard this before. But you can dig in if you're willing. We'll give it away to you for free. Send us an email, td@kpcg.fm, and we'll send out a free copy of this wonderful new book, well over 200 pages, just as soon as we can. You can start reading today if you like. Just go over to thetrumpet.com and get your free copy. The True History of God's True Church. So much of it, as I say, has been wiped out, obscured. And then you look at all that's happening in this world today. So much darkness. That's ultimately what Satan's attempting to do. To just wipe out the truth. To wipe out God's people, any way, every way that he can. But we can take heart in the fact that, as I said earlier, Jesus himself promised that God's church would survive. And in these latter days, there's a number of prophecies that assure us that God's church, the work of God's church, will thrive. Not just survive. It will thrive. There's such an important work to be done in this dying world. Where is it? I mean, where can you go to get the truth, to understand why what's happening is happening? Well, you can come to this very radio station, KPCG. You can watch The Key of David anywhere in the world with all the many television stations that we're on. And, of course, with the program itself being available on the Trumpet website as well. As I said earlier, you'll want to go to the website tomorrow to watch the newest program that my father produced on these negotiations that were completed last week with Iran over its nuclear program. And then again next week, as he talks more about what's happened in recent weeks in Europe with the Greek financial crisis and the German conquest of Greece, and where all of this is leading. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream is at kpcg.fm. Thank you for listening today, and we'll see you again tomorrow.